In 1966, Time magazine screened the headline, "God is Dead." Many believe he is or think there is no God, and those people we label as atheists. Some others don't know or doubt the existence of God. Those are labeled as agnostics. I happen to have a son. He was raised in the church, born in the church. However, went to a university, got his degree in political science, and has told us he is at least an agnostic, if not an atheist. And I just shake my head. I don't talk much with him because his views and my views do not match, and I don't want to get into an argument with him. But he has admitted he's an agnostic. He doesn't really know whether God exists or not. Here's an interesting thing I found in a professional journal that I used to subscribe to. A man named James H. Luba, a sociologist in 1914, polled 400 of the best scientists of the time. So this was in 1914. One of his questions was, do you believe in a personal God? And how he defined a personal God was one that you can pray to and expect an answer. Well, 32% of those people believed in a personal God. The other question was about immortality. Did they believe in immortality? 37% of those top 400 scientists in 1914 said yes, they did. In 1933, the same questions were asked. And this time the numbers dropped. 13% for those who believed in a personal God, and 15% for those who believed in immortality. So they dropped to about half. And then in 2007, which is what this graphic shows, maybe. There we go. Just have to push the wheel the right way. This is a poll of those same questions in 2007. And what we see here is that the numbers have dropped to 10% for those who believe in a personal God and 10% for those who believe in immortality. Notice the question on the front cover of this newspaper magazine. This is the Boston Globe magazine from 2007. And down below you see the question, do you believe in God? The article inside this magazine speaks about the growing number of unbelievers, those who don't believe in God. A Pew survey in March 2007 concluded the nation is witnessing a reversal of the increased religiosity observed in the mid-1990s. So in the mid-1990s, people were becoming more religious. And then when we get into the 2000s, there's a reversal of that. Atheists, agnostics now call themselves humanists. These believe there is no God, say they cannot prove his existence, and therefore mankind is responsible for taking care of himself. That's why they're called humanists. Probably can't read the sign very well, but this is what the sign says. This sign is inside the Harvard Humanist Society. There's actually a society at Harvard called the Humanist Society. If you call yourself atheist, agnostic, agnostic, non-religious, a free thinker, rationalist, secular, spiritual, skeptic, cynic, secular, humanist, naturalist, deist, nothing, or any number of the non-religious descriptives, you could probably count yourself a humanist. And then down in the smaller print, 1 billion people around the world, 30 to 40 million Americans. One in five Americans age 18 to 25 identify with no religion. Now this was in 2007. I got an update of that a little bit. It is now one in three people between the ages of 18 and 29 that would consider themselves to be humanists. That are either agnostic, they don't know whether God exists, or they're completely atheists. And that figure came out of an article that popped up on Drudge. Drudge is a sort of gives you headlines of the news, and if you want to go in, you can read the article. The article was interviewing people at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia, students there. And the reason they wrote the article is these students want to stay in the closet, so to speak, about their atheism and their agnosticism. They actually interviewed one lady that was majored in chemical engineering and said she doesn't want to tell anybody she's an agnostic for fear of not being able to find a job. Because she's afraid her employers would be religious and that they would discriminate against her for not believing or not being able to prove whether or not there is a God. So is there a God? An almighty, all-powerful, created being who has brought matter into existence and sustains it. Can we know for sure whether or not God exists? And that should be a resounding yes for us. There are proofs of God's existence. And that's what I would like to do today for the time I have left, is to go over those proofs of God's existence so that we can know there is a God. We don't have to doubt. We don't have to say there is no God, as Time magazine said. Without acknowledging the existence of God, man continues to speculate on the formation of the universe. This is a picture of what they think happened in the Big Bang. They've got this out of telescope and satellite measurements. To the left is the initial point that it started. And I'm going to use the word Big Bang event because I don't want us to think about the television show The Big Bang Theory. I'm a scientist. If I'm that geeky, shoot me now. That's not... I know physicists. I know biochemists. I know chemists. They don't act that way. I know it's a comedy on television, but you're looking here at the Big Bang event, where there was an initial spark and then the universe expanded tremendously and quickly. So that initial spark occurs on the left and the rest of it shows its expansion out to the modern day place where the satellite and the telescope sits. That they created this from, the measurements that took this and they created this from. In describing what took place in the beginning and afterwards, they use phrases such as perhaps, probably, suggest a plausible explanation. And I know they do this because I do this when I write an article. I use those terms as a scientist. It's just typical scientific writing. Now, I worked for a man for 6 years. We looked at contractile proteins. Every time we'd have a lab meeting and discuss an article about what we were examining, and we talk about how proteins contract to allow, how proteins work to allow your muscles to contract. You know, one of the last things he would say in the meeting after we've discussed this is, only God knows. And I just sit there and think to myself, you're right. Only God knows. Because many times we don't have a clue as to what's going on. Especially something like this that supposedly took place 13.5 billion years ago. We weren't there. We don't know what went on. We know there had to be a beginning. The Bible states that. But we don't know when, how. This is man's speculation. I've given this before. I've saved this article until a little later, but I'm going to go skip to it now because it actually, you can get a sense of them using the words that I just talked about and describing what goes on, what they think went on without a creator. This is out of a very prestigious journal known as Nature. If you talk to somebody about what are the prestigious scientific journals, they'll say science, they'll say Nature. And it's about how cells came about. In particular, what they call a eukaryote, which are the cells that mammals have and fish have. They don't know how those evolved. The title of the article is Engulfed by Speculation. This is about a 2007 article. This is a 2007 article. Engulfed by speculation. So 7 years ago, they're still talking about how did mammal cells evolve? And there's some interesting things here. In the absence of direct evidence, science should proceed cautiously with conjecture. But they don't. They don't proceed cautiously with conjecture. Oh, they use the words, but then when you go to talk to them, well, yeah, this is definite. I sat in a class a year ago this last fall. And I listened to this guy who was measuring the beliefs down south of the teachers and the students about evolution. Because in the south, unlike the northeast where I'm from, they'll still teach creationism in school. You know, and it was, as a biologist, he wanted that to go away. So at the end of his talk, we had to sit there and listen to him answer questions for an hour. And I asked him, so can you really prove evolution? Well, actually, I think he was being a little derogatory about those who didn't believe in it. So I raised my hand and said, well, you know, you're being a little derogatory to us, somebody like me who does not believe in it. And he looks back at me and he says, well, it's up to you to prove it. Well, as you can see from this article, it wasn't up to me to prove it. It's not my theory. It's not one I believe in. So anyway, you should proceed cautiously. And the guy goes on to say that in the Middle Ages, what scientists would do in the Middle Ages is they would come up with this really wild theory and then try to prove it because they thought that was really scientific. They thought that was really scientific. But it wasn't. I was just being stupid. And unfortunately, today we're seeing that in some things that we look at in science. We come up with this really wild theory, let's prove it, and let's get everybody to believe it, and then say we have proved it when we haven't. I'm going to drop down to another paragraph. In other words, the onus is on the proponents, not skeptics, to find evidence for their theories. So see, that biology teacher was totally wrong in telling me to prove evolution was wrong. Because I'm the skeptic. And what's this article say from a very prestigious scientific journal? He's the one that needs to prove evolution. And one of their last sentences is, there is much uncertainty. Notice one of those words, possibly, plausibly. There is much uncertainty surrounds eukaryote origins. This is a 2007 article, not a 1900 article. They still don't know. Go on and notice what they say about what I just showed you. The universe is expanding gradually now, but its initial expanse was almost impossibly rapid, as it likely grew from quantum scale fluctuations in a trillionth of a second. And now it's slowed down. And they're not sure if it's still expanding. Some believe it is, some believe it isn't. And by the way, there are other theories about what's going on in the universe. I only took the Big Bang event because this is known as the standard model, and this is what many people are taught in college and in high school as to the origin of the universe. And the other theories don't even come up. You know, a question that's never answered here is, where did the laws governing this explosion come from? In order to have an explosion, there are laws that are involved. You're not going to get an explosion unless something has taken place, and there are laws that govern that. Here are some of the laws. The gas laws. There are laws that govern how gases behave. And there were definitely gases made here. Hydrogen gas. Helium. The law of conservation of matter, which simply states that you cannot create or destroy matter. It's a law that all chemists work under. When a chemist does a chemical reaction, he has to account for the matter in that reaction. It's an interesting thing. You think somebody would have done this long before Lavoisier. Lavoisier was a scientist in the late 1700s. Before Lavoisier did his very simple experiment, chemists or those working with chemical reactions believed that in some reactions, some things would disappear in the universe, that just magic, it just disappeared into the atmosphere, went away. And in other chemical reactions, this thing that just went away came back into the reaction, just magically. Lavoisier comes along, he takes a couple of chemicals, puts them into a vial, seals them, weighs the vial, lets the reaction proceed, weighs the closed vial at the end, and what does he find? Well, he finds out that the mass of the vial in the beginning is the same as the mass of the vial at the end. Matter wasn't magically disappearing. Matter was not magically disappearing or magically coming in. He's the one credited for finding the law of... He didn't make it. He discovered the law of conservation of matter. The first law of thermodynamics, which is simply the law of conservation of energy. You cannot create or destroy energy. It gets transferred. It can be changed from one form to another, but you cannot create or destroy it. The law of gravity. Try defying that one. It's not going to work so well for us if we go someplace and jump down. Because we're going to go down. We're not going to float up. The laws of kinetics, which is how fast a chemical reaction goes. There are laws governing the speed of a chemical reaction. And these all had to be involved in that Big Bang that supposedly started the universe. We can continue to ask, were they already in existence, these laws? Or did they just appear out of nowhere? The models contain actions that are orderly, governed by irrefutable laws of nature. And so here we come to proof number one, that God exists. And that is the existence of active, unchangeable, irrefutable, and irrevocable laws demand a lawgiver. Laws demand a lawgiver. And there had to be laws. If you take a look at the way they think things formed in the universe, there were laws involved. There's laws involved with keeping the moon around the earth around the sun. Those, specifically the law of gravity. Let's go to James 4. James chapter 4. What I have on the board is out of the Weymouth version. James 4, starting in verse 11. Which says, do not speak evil of one another, brethren. The man who speaks evil of a brother man or judges his brother man speaks evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge law, you are no longer the one who obeys law, but one who judges it. The only real lawgiver, this is the point I want to emphasize, the only real lawgiver and judge is he who is able to save or to destroy. Who are you to sit in judgment on your fellow man? God is the only lawgiver. And he put laws in place to govern however he created this universe. Whether it was through that initial moment that we call the Big Bang event, or some other way that he may have put this universe together. He put in motion those laws. He's put in motion physical laws and spiritual laws. And laws that we probably don't even understand, that he hasn't seen fit to let us know about yet. What about the theory of evolution? So after the universe is created, then life sparks up on this earth. The theory of evolution in the simplest form states the following. All life forms that are known, including humankind, have gradually evolved, developed slowly from the most simple to the complex, intricate, and interdependent species we know today. They started from they started from chemicals, produced a one-cell creature. The one-cell creatures were then able to aggregate into multi-cell creatures, and they kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Until eventually humans show up at whatever point in the evolutionary tree that they occur. Notice what Darwin said. This is kind of funny because we still believe this today. And this was Darwin's theory. He, and that's Darwin, made the suggestion that life may have begun in a warm little pond with all sorts of ammonia and phosphoric salts, lights, heat, electricity present. That a protein compound was chemically formed, ready to undergo still more complex changes. At the present day, such matter would be instantly devoured or absorbed, which would not have been the case before living creatures were formed. Thus, it is the presence of life itself which prevents spontaneous generation from occurring on Earth today. This was a letter that Darwin wrote to J.D. Hooker. You go up to a person who believes in evolution, ask them how life started. That's what they will tell you. That over eons, the water eroded the rocks. The rocks changed into these chemicals. Through lightning and heat, these chemicals changed into biochemicals. And somehow the biochemicals knew enough to get together to form a simple life form. How ridiculous is that? Why are they looking for water on Mars? Because if they can find water, then they can try to make the case that, life may have evolved on Mars. It just at some point it disappeared. They've even gone to the point of saying, we've got these chemicals that we see in the universe. And if they land on the right planet and the lightning strikes, there's the possibility of evolution occurring. Let's hope the creatures that they think about developing on other planets don't look like the creatures that you see in sci-fi. Most of them have a reptilian nature to them. I wonder why. Most of the creatures that are sci-fi creatures that come from other planets are reptile in nature. What scientists believe is that life came from non-living material. Life came from non-living material. But they ought to know better. Because look what happened with Louis Pasteur. In 1864, Louis Pasteur finally announced the results of his scientific experiments. In a series of neat experiments, Pasteur proved conclusively that only pre-existing microbes could give rise to other microbes. This is known as biogenesis. Life comes from life. Proven by a scientist back in the 1800s. And yet we don't believe that. We believe life came from rocks. From a primordial soup that came out of those rocks and struck by lightning. And so here we have proof number two. Right? Life demands a life giver. Life demands a life giver. Life has to come from life. Everything on this earth that's alive had to come from a life giver. It had to come from something alive. It can't come from something non-living. Go to Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2. and verse 7. Genesis 2 and verse 7. And the eternal God formed man out of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And man became a living being. Now, it doesn't tell us whether God did this for all the other living creatures, but he probably did. Because they have life in them. They have the breath of life. Then we can go on to ask, where did matter come from? Where did matter come from? Many believe matter has always existed. There's a past eternity to matter. Matter of fact, if you talk to some cosmologists, and I didn't read off these names at the beginning, but one of the guys that's part of the atheist crew is Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan was a cosmologist. He studied the universe. And he was an atheist. Didn't believe in God. But some of the people that are cosmologists believe that the universe is going to expand to a certain point and then contract and then flash up again, expand, and then contract to this one singular point and then again expand. It's what some believe. But nature itself shows that there's not a past eternity to matter. This is what's known as a radioactive decay series. At the top is uranium-238. Uranium's an element. You can go out west in Nevada and find pitchblende, which is a mineral. And pitchblende contains uranium. Uranium decays over a matter of time down to lead-206. And it does this through losing pieces of matter out of the nucleus of its atoms, as well as energy. And that takes a certain length of time. Just the first step alone to go from uranium-238 to thorium-234... takes 4.5 billion years. This is how some people age the earth. This is how they tell how old the earth is they find how much lead-206 there is. And then they work their way backwards, but through a very simple mathematical equation that will tell them how much uranium you started with. And you can calculate from this equation, if you know all the right things, you can calculate the time. This is a time clock. And this had to start someplace. There had to be a beginning in order for this decay to take place. There had to be a beginning. By the way, without going into too much detail, if you look about in the middle, you see that radon-222. That's the stuff that can collect in some people's basements. And then if it's not taken care of, can give them lung cancer. But that comes out of basements that are generally put in clay, because clay is where you're going to find the uranium. So if people wonder where radon comes from and they have it in their basement, it's because you're around a deposit of clay. And it sneaks through the basement through cracks. So here we see that there was a beginning to radioactive decay. And that beginning dictates a creator. The beginning dictates a creator. John 1. John 1 in verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him nothing was made that was made. We see a beginning. We see a Creator. So we find that there is a life giver, a law giver, and now we see that there's a Creator. And God didn't stop with this earth. This is a picture from NASA's, you can go in and look all kinds of space pictures on NASA's astronomy picture of the day, it's called, on the web. There are some gorgeous pictures on there. This is an interstellar nursery. This is where stars are being formed now. God's still creating. There are stars. We talk about stars dying because we see their light from millions of years ago. So we kind of think they must be dead. But now they found out that there are actually stars being created in other parts of the universe. Not only that, you can read through various articles and find out that they're discovering new species all the time. Probably about 3 weeks ago, I read through an article in which this American biologist is jumping up and down for joy because they found a new species of fish in the United States. Something they thought they would never do. Almost impossible to do here because they think they found every species there is in the United States. Most of the new species being found are being found in the middle of the jungle where very, very few people have ever lived. And then on top of that, things are starting to come back. For instance, there's this one town in England. They haven't seen a beaver for 800 years. What shows up? A beaver. They found animals they thought were extinct. And all of a sudden, you know, I remember reading this one article. It's photographers in South America. And this lizard passes him, so he takes a picture of it, puts it on the internet, and biologists are going wild. They thought this lizard was extinct. And God's not sitting up there doing nothing. He is a creator. He continues to create. Look at what He's already created. If you ask me what my favorite birds are, I'd have to tell you they're raptors. This is known as a goshawk. Might be more of a New England bird than it is a bird down here. This is not the hawk that you see sitting on the interstate. Those tend to be the red tail or the broad tail hawks. This hawk is designed by God to live in the forest. His wings, his body, are all made to fly through trees and brush in pursuit of its prey. Specifically designed to live in the deep forest. You take the usual hawk you see on the interstate, he has to hunt in the open field. This one can hunt in the middle of the forest, no problem, because of its design. And God is like that. He's taken the same species and He's made different species is probably the wrong word. He's taken the same kind and made different species that have different functions. So that's proof number three. Creation requires a creator. So laws require a lawgiver. Life requires a life giver. Creation requires a creator. Genesis 1, verse 25. Actually, verse 24. Says in these verses, then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, and cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So here we see God made things after their own kind. Cows after cows, dogs after dogs, sheep after sheep. Through the study of genetics, selective breeding, and the comparison of embryos of different species, man has attempted to disprove this verse. They claim since embryos of different species, such as fish, polywogs, pigs, chickens, and humans, look similar in their first stages of development, they had to have a common ancestor. Well, yeah, they had a common ancestor. They actually had a common creator is what they had. What I have here is a picture of two embryos. It's not very good quality, but they do look similar at this point. The one on the left is a pig embryo. The one on the right is a chicken embryo. If you look at these closely, you cannot tell them apart. Well, does that prove evolution? Does that prove that they came from a one-celled creature way, way back? Actually, to me, what it shows is that there is a God who designed everything. That shows design to me. Now, as the chemicals work in there, they're going to change into what they need to be as they grow. They're going to change into the pig, and they're going to change into the chicken. This is a common design to life that could only be given by a great designer, by a creator. We know a chicken embryo can't turn into a pig, even though man may try. It isn't going to happen. God set in motion a law that prohibits life forms from changing from one species to another. There is variety in each species, as you can see from these two types of dogs. And they can mix dog types. I mean, you can mix these two dog types, but you're not going to get a rat. You're going to get another dog that's a mix between a husky and a poodle. And so we have proof number four. And that is that kind reproduces after its own kind. I want to interject something here that I probably should have interjected a little bit earlier, especially in terms of the Big Bang event. Please, when you get a chance, go on to Life, Hope, and Truth. Being one of the writing teams, I get to review the articles that come through on things like the Big Bang. And there is an article, I think I checked the other day, it's not up yet, but there is one coming that does a very nice job on explaining what I've tried to explain in a few minutes in a little longer article. There are articles coming on these proofs. We're going to write it. The writing team that I'm on is going to write an article for each one of these proofs. Yes, I'm plugging the literature, but I mean, it's if you see this in print as well, hopefully you can understand why there is a God. A powerful, all-knowing, all-powerful being. When you look at things, have you considered how intricate and complex they are? And how interdependent everything is on other things? There's this synergy to things. How about considering DNA, of which this is a tiny piece? A rendering of what DNA looks like, developed by Watson and Crick way back in the early 50s. These all those lines are actually aren't lines. They're molecules. They're chemicals that are put together. And those little things that look like ladder runs are just bonds between those chemicals that exist that hold this alpha helix together. This molecule contains the production codes for every protein in your body. Not only there are proteins that are active that are called enzymes. So it contains the production codes for those enzymes as well. But this contains the information for your height, your skin color, your hair color, your facial features, the length of your fingers. Pretty interesting for just a bunch of chemicals thrown together. In conjunction with various forms of its cousin molecule RNA, the protein code it contains is transformed into a functioning protein. As I said, I studied myosin and actin, the contractile proteins. Those are the proteins that allow your muscles to contract. It's just amazing how they function. And that what came from the DNA code that told them to function that way. That actually produced the myosin and actin in the way that it has to be produced in order for your muscles to contract. It makes us who we are physically. If one part of this messes up, then there's a defect. If there's a miscode in here, there's a defect that happens. And many times those defects aren't survivable. And so this is why evolution have come up with this idea of the survival of the fittest. Because they think over the millions of years, the defects that were good turned into something. And it made a new species. Defects are bad? Well, they didn't survive. And I read an article a while back on how heads came into existence through evolution. Some kind of slug just decided it needed a head, and then it just these defects just occurred and the head occurs. Really? Or a good one the other day was, well, we found out how some fish made jaws. They started out with this fish with just a face. And I'm thinking, the fish I've seen with just a face are suckers. So you're telling me this sucker fish somehow had a defect in which now it's going to elongate its mouth? And that's going to turn into jaws and teeth? But that's what they were pumping. That's the concept they were trying to get across. Even the point of saying, well, if you looked at this original fish that didn't have a jaw, and you looked at it in the mirror, it looked like a human. Really? Thought it was a fish. Notice what David says in Psalm 139. Psalm 139 and verse 14. David might have been a sheep herder, but he was intelligent. He had time to think and contemplate. And notice what he says. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works. And that my soul knows very well. David knew he was wonderfully and fearfully made. If you watch the actions of animals, you know they had to be created. They just didn't show up on their own. They didn't show up on their own. The complex and interdependent steps required to produce the genetic code that form this butterfly's wings support the existence of a great designer. There are two pictures here. On the left-hand side is a butterfly's wing magnified down to 10 microns. A micron is a millionth of a meter, or a millionth, a meter is 3 feet, so it's a millionth of 3 feet. That's a micron. Well, actually, the left one is 10 microns, so that's a little larger. And then the other one on the right-hand side is what those butterfly feathers look like and they do look like feathers. You may not, you don't see this when you pick up a butterfly, but these look like feathers of a bird. That's what those feathers look like down at 1 micron on the other side. The ribs that go through there and the cross member support that's there. This is taken through a very powerful microscope. And there's design there. There's a reason this is made this way. And that's so the butterfly can fly. And so here we see proof number 5. Design in the universe requires a designer. Design in the universe requires a designer. Let's go to Isaiah 46. I want to begin in verse 9 of Isaiah 46. Remember the former things of old. For I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from the ancient times things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Calling a bird of prey from the east, the man who executes my counsel from a far country. Indeed, I have spoken it. I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it. I will also do it. God here telling us that He foreknows, or He knows the future. He knows the future. Because He's in control. God is in control. And once again, I don't know when it's going to get posted, but there is an article on this. This proof that I'm about to cover coming out in Life, Hope, and Truth. I just went over just one of the review. I was one of the reviewers the other day. Read it through to make sure things were okay. As I think there are 9 of us on the team, so we all have to read every article that comes out before it even gets published. But there is one on this proof that we're going to go over. Notice that God said He declares the end from the beginning. He knows. He knows. 1/3 of the Bible is prophecy. Most pertain to the end time, but others have already been fulfilled. Throughout Scripture, we find God sending forth His prophets to various places, foretelling the fall and particular fate of governments, cities, and individuals. And without fail, these prophecies have come to pass. Some, as I said, others are still future, but will come to pass. Turn with me to 1 Kings 21. In 1 Kings 21, verse 23, we have the prophecy about the demise of a very wicked woman. Probably the second most wicked woman in the Bible. The first probably being Nimrod's wife. This woman wasn't far behind her. This woman caused all kinds of trouble in Israel. And got Israel to worship idols, engraven images, and sacrifice to gods that it shouldn't have been sacrificing to. This is a prophecy that was made by Elijah. And it says, and concerning Jezebel, the Lord also spoke, saying, the dog shall eat Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel. Now turn to 2 Kings 9. The time span between 1 Kings 21 and 2 Kings 9 is around 25 years. And we'll begin in verse 33. Now, what's happened those 25 years? Well, Ahab, who was Jezebel's husband, king of Israel, has died. He met his demise, which was also forecast by God. He was told he was going to die. And he did in the exact way that God said he would die. Ahab's son took over, ran the kingdom, and he was an absolute horrid king, as many of the kings of Israel and Judah were, because they did not follow God's way. So God was going to dispose of... So God was going to dispose of Ahab's son. And what you find, the prophet now is Elisha. The prophet now is Elisha. And what Elisha did is he told his servant to go find this commander on the battlefield, because the Israelites were at war, as they usually were during this time. Go find this commander named Jehu and anoint him king over Israel. In giving instructions to his servant, Elisha told the servant, "And after you anoint Jehu, you better get out of there. You better run." So Elisha's servant goes and finds Jehu. He pours oil all over him, and the soldiers and Jehu said, "What's going on?" And so the servant says, "I'm anointing you king of Israel." And then he got out of there just like he was told, as fast as he could. So now Jehu takes over. The present king of Israel is killed in battle. And we pick up the story in verse 33 of 2 Kings 9. "Then he said," and that he is Jehu, the new king of Israel, "throw her down." He came into where Jezebel was. She came to the window of, I don't want to call it a castle, but she came to the window of the building she was living in. He says, "Throw her down." So they threw her down. And the people that threw her down were a couple of her caretakers. They were behind her. And they looked out the window and they said yes they would to Jehu. And they threw her out of this window. "And some of her blood splattered on the wall and on the horses, and he trampled her underfoot. And when he had gone in, he ate and drank. And then he said, 'Go now, see to this accursed woman and bury her, for she was a king's daughter.' So they went to bury her, but they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands." She was gone. "Therefore they came back and told him, and he said, 'This is the word of the Eternal, which he spoke by his servant Elijah the Tishbite, saying, On the plot of ground at Jezreel, dogs shall eat the flesh of Jezebel. And the corpse of Jezebel shall be his refuge on the surface of the field, in the plot at Jezreel, so that they shall not say, Here lies Jezebel.'" A prophecy fulfilled that was prophesied by Elijah 25 years, at least 25 years prior to this. Let's not forget about the prophecies of Christ, his first coming, his death, resurrection, which all came to pass. The fact that God can foretell the future and bring it about is another proof of his existence. And so there's proof number 6, fulfilled prophecy. Fulfilled prophecy. And then proof number 7 is answered prayer. Answered prayer. Here we need to ask, what is real answered prayer? Well, it is not the mere working of the events as a result of concentration, positive thinking, or psychological adjustment. In other words, prayer is going to be answered if you concentrate, if you think positively, or if you make some kind of psychological adjustment. Answered prayer comes from being obedient to God's law, asking according to His will, and believing in faith until the answer comes. This is this picture up here I have is supposedly a picture of David praying. As you well know, David prayed 3 times a day, morning, noon, and night, as was his custom. Daniel did the same thing. It was their custom back then. Let's go to James 5. James 5 and verse 16, confess your trespasses to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effective fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. So we can, through our prayers, help those that we know that have shingles. Help those that we know are having problems and difficulties with other health issues. Help those that are having problems with their families or with their jobs. Or just with the country they live in, like those that live in Africa and South America. For each and every one of us, we've had prayers answered in our lives. My third son, we had the tricycle in the house. So he was riding around the house. He'd just taken a carrot. He's biting on the carrot. Next thing he does is he tips over the tricycle, takes in a breath, and a piece of the carrot winds up in his lung. So he's having a little bit of difficulty breathing. We run him down to the emergency room. We call the minister in the area to come anoint him. They took an x-ray. Sure enough, you look at the x-ray, there's the piece of carrot sitting in the lung. Mr. Myers was the minister in the area, so he comes and anoints our son. Stays a little bit, leaves. They come back, they take another x-ray. And guess what was gone? They were just shaking their heads. Well, here's this x-ray, there's something there. And the second x-ray, there's nothing. God intervened. He dissolved that carrot piece somehow. Poor little guy still had to stay overnight. They wanted him there for observation, but the carrot was no longer in his lungs, which could have led to pneumonia and other health problems. It was removed through the power of prayer and asking God to intervene. Man is blinded from seeing the existence of God. He is seeking answers and explanations on his own terms. Let's notice this in Romans 1. In verses 17 through 25. For the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. And that's what it is. For us to believe in God, it's faith. Just like it's faith for anybody who believes that we started from a primordial soup and have gotten to where we are, that's faith on their part. Faith is evidence of things not seen. They didn't see that beginning. They're taking geological pieces and trying to put those together under a mistaken thought process, as we'll see here. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Did they do it intentionally? More than likely not. We know that there is a being out there that does not like man and does not want God's plan fulfilled. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. The world around us shows us there is a God. And those that say there isn't, or those that say they don't know, are without excuse. My second son is without excuse. Because all he has to do is look a little closer. Get the prejudice out of his mind. Verse 21, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness, in the lust of their hearts, to dishonor the bodies among themselves, who changed the truth of God for the lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. God allowed their minds to go in this direction because they weren't going to listen to him anyway. And so they come up with their own things, their own imaginations of how it all started. And of course, it's contrary to there being a Creator God or any being that was more powerful than them. Notice what man believes. The universe is 10 billion years old because it takes about that long for intelligent beings to evolve. It's probably the brightest guy on the planet right now. Well, he's not so bright, but, you know. If you ask anybody, Stephen Hawking is an extremely intelligent man. But look at the dribble he came up with. It takes 10 billion years for man to come into existence. Where did you get it? Where's your proof? And as I said earlier, the onus is on him. Where's his proof? We are blessed because our minds have been opened to understand the proofs of God's existence. And that's what's helped us. An understanding. If God didn't open my mind when I was young, I'd be right there with him. As a scientist, I'd be right there with him. But God chose to open my mind at a very early age. And I began to see that there was a Creator. That there was an Almighty Being who is in charge of everything. Does God exist? Yes. How do we know God exists? Because laws demand a lawgiver. So there had to be a lawgiver. Life demands a life giver. Can't have life from nothing. Life had to supply life. Creation requires a creator. All of this was made. Once again, there's an excellent article on what's called irreducible complexity. How you get down to the various simplest things that appear simple. They're not that simple. Species reproducing after species. The design requires a designer. The fact that there's fulfilled prophecy. And then answered prayer. All show that there is a God. Let's keep these things in mind. So we know that God isn't dead, but he is alive and well.